Okay, could you tell us the story about the moose? One of your moose stories.
Well, we had a calf moose calf prowling around the neighborhood, apparently separated from its mother, and we were trying to figure out, what do we do with it? We don't want the thing here. If we try to do something towards feeding it and whatnot, that just may encourage it to stay. The dogs just could not leave the calf alone, and so we tied a piece of 3/8-inch log chain to the dog's neck.
Well, you might add that we were down in the woods cutting wood with them. We had the tractor, which is why you have this long chain.
Down in these woods over here?
Well, over this way, down George Road.
Oh, I see. And that's where the moose was?
That's where the calf showed up. Mm-hmm.
And then I get lost and wonder, what did we
do? Well, you tied the chain, the logging chain, to the dog?
Which was enough weight to keep the dog from running very fast. It wasn't attached to anything, but it was just heavy. And, but the dogs also found out that that moose calf, although it was pretty young, had a very powerful kick, if you remember. Just about bowled a dog over.
Which dog was that?
Oh, this would have been Kopic and Mushroom, I think.
Yeah.
Some of our earliest.
Mushroom.
Yeah, white dog.
Yeah.
But then what? We managed to get home without it following us, as I remember, and hoped it would go find Mama. And then the next thing I remember, Harold had spotted it, come across it. We may have called around the neighborhood or something. And then we did try to feed it. And we had the big nipples that you put on a pop bottle or something for pigs. And we got that out.
Nipples.
Yeah. And I don't know what kind of milk we tried or water or anything. But I remember Harold administering this. And, it didn't do any good. The poor thing died of dehydration. I think it was a very young, what did we figure? It was a week old, maybe?
Yeah.
And we never did. We were looking over our shoulders for Mama all this time, because you never knew when she was going to show up, you know.
Yeah.
But we never did see her, so something had probably happened to her.
Chased her off or killed
her. Yeah.
What do you remember about, are there any other moose stories you can think of? Or encounters with wild animals?
Oh, yeah.
The back porch threw on the stick.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had one. Oh, we had one that chased the cat into the woodshed one time. I don't know if that's when we threw it. But I'm thinking of the time that Al was homesick with a flu, and I'm out in the living room, and here is this cow moose standing there charging the window. She saw me, and she charged right at one of our big windows.
On the west side?
On the west side of the house. So I went in, I thought this is worth getting Al up for, even if he is sick. And he comes grumbling out and walks over the window, and she charges. She stops short of the glass, but not much.
Gee whiz.
So at that point, I think I said in the diary that somebody else, like Dorothy, called Fish and Game. We hadn't, for some reason. But anyway, while we're waiting for Fish and Game to get here, I called Ann and I called Beatrice, because either of them were likely to walk by, and I didn't want them running into it.
And it was about time for the school bus to dump kids up on the hot
sun. So this was a muddy season, must have been the spring. So pretty quick, here come Ann and George driving by to see this moose. And they go down to the corner and they turn around and come back. And this time the moose takes out after them. And
after
running,
their car?
After their car. They couldn't get up a lot of speed because of the mud. And it was just kind of looking in the back window, you know, hanging over the back of the car. And I think Ann said something about, she made some comment about, I don't remember what it was. But I remember noticing that moose growled. Because while this was going on.
Growled?
Yeah, it made some kind of noises in its throat. While they had the moose pulled off that way, I went out with the dogs off the chain because they'd been chained by their houses. And I was afraid she'd attack them. And then about then the Fish and Wildlife guy shows up, pulls into the driveway, gets out of his car and gets chased right back at him. So then we're talking sign language out between the car and the house, and he comes across to the other side of the car, which is closer to the front door, and we open the door and he comes tearing in. And he ends up having to shoot it because it was belligerent.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't anything else he could do. He missed the first time.
Oh, no.
Or at least it wasn't a fatal shot the first time, but he did get her down. And then they have to call the meat wagon and get it hauled off. And then the kids come home from school and they get into our driveway. And this is the seventh kid then, ours, probably, I don't know. And they see all this blood in the yard.
Oh, no.
Whose dogs? Whose dogs got into such a terrible fight? Because that's what.
Oh, man.
Several dogs that our dogs frequently did fight.
Oh.
And, so that was the end of it. But turned out when they butchered the moose out, it had broken ribs. And obviously it had a run-in with a truck or something.
Oh, so it was.
And so it was mad. It was hurting.
Mean.
Yeah.
I see.
So that kind of explained why it was so belligerent.
Well, did you ever have any run-ins with bears out here?
Oh, well, we had them around.
Yeah. Had them around.
No run-ins, though.
We used to have a garbage dump down between here and the cabin.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the bears kept digging in our garbage. Every once in a while, you'd hear something going, and you knew that the bear was down there digging in the garbage.
Rattling tin cans.
Mm-hmm. So I decided, I'm going to get rid of this animal. Because it's going to get tangled up with a kid or something, and then we don't know. So anyhow, I get the aught-six, and I go pick a spot where I know that the bear is going to be full view. And I sit down and wait, because this is about the time in the afternoon that the moose shows up.
The moose or the bear?
I mean the bear. And after a while, I wake up to the fact that I've been snoozing, sleeping. And I thought, oh, nuts. And I get up and start to walk off, and I can see fresh digging around in the thing.
Around you or in the garbage?
In the garbage.
And
but
how?
The garbage is like from here to those pictures over there.
About 40 feet.
Yeah.
30 feet.
And I obviously also have missed the moose.
The bear, come on, stick with the animal.
Get this from my head. But anyhow, we had a bear that regularly visited because at that time we didn't have enough sense to quit feeding the garbage.
Yes. We got rid of the garbage dump not too long after that.
I would think
yeah,
so.
Yeah, covered it up. Oh, there was also the time that we had a dog plastered against the screen door, the storm door, so we couldn't open it because apparently there was a wolf that had attacked Tok-Tok,
yeah.
A Herald dog.
Uh-huh.
And our dogs didn't like that. They wanted to come in.
You think they heard the massacre going on?
Yeah, they heard something, yeah. Yeah, they heard something.
Harold was yelling. He had his aught-six out.
Uh-huh.
And the wolf obviously took off. But Tok-Tok had pups at the time, and so she was in a very protective mood.
Right.
Harold wanted his dog protected.
I think she got chewed up a little bit, not seriously,
not
as
sure.
I remember. Mm-hmm. But the dogs heard enough that they knew it was a very dangerous situation, mm-hmm. and we couldn't open the door to let them in.
They were
pushed up against the boy. Let them in.
You went through the same grill at Valdez with the white dog?
Yeah, I think it was Mushroom. Sitting on the tent flap, the tent door, and that was bears too, wasn't it?
It was bears also.
Yeah.
She went inside.
Yeah, that's right.
Didn't know that piece of cloth wasn't too good.
We just get off the damn flap, yeah. We'll let you in.
Yeah. What about porcupines? Did they get into your garden?
Oh, yeah, we had a few porcupine incidents. Not too many. We must not have a lot of porcupines around.
Yeah.
Well, it depends on who and where you are. Were you with me when we had all the porcupines at
Paxson?
Paxson?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Well, those stupid dogs.
I'm thinking the road out of Petersburg that goes where we counted what? Like 30 or 40?
Oh, no, I don't remember that.
Porcupines?
No. They must have more down there than we do.
Oh, they run in cycles.
Yeah.
I thought of two other things I wanted to ask you about. I just discovered them. What do you remember about the flood in 1967, the Fairbanks flood? How it affected you? Or
that was a long story. Well, Al's flood stories have to do with the university, so I don't know whether you want that in here.
I was the campus civil defense coordinator, which was a job that was required because of the federal government's housing plans for civil defense.
Well, it was a cold. It was a Cold War
right.
program. Mm-hmm. This was that period.
And the university had to have somebody to respond to these things that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I got stuck with it, which was fine. I could roll with the punches and mm-hmm. whatnot. But all of a sudden, after several years of this almost referred to as nonsense, why the flood happened. And the flood happened rather severely.
Mm-hmm.
And we now know why it was severely, but at the time, we didn't realize that when you got a floodwater report from the Corps of Engineers, it was something that was written on a postcard and dropped in the mail when they happened to think of dropping it in the mail.
Oh, that was from Anchorage, wasn't it?
And
wasn't that the headquarters?
Yeah.
Oh,
and
my
so we asked the flood people to give us a reading on what this is going to come to. And they say, well, we're going to have a crest at such and such, and it'll be this high and whatnot. And lo and behold, when they say it's going to be this high, it's already gone 18 inches higher. So in the process of all this, it was pretty obvious that we were going to have some kind of what do we do with all these people situation arise. And so I went out and talked with Doc Wood and explained to him that we were probably going to be asked to house as many people as we could possibly get on campus, and how does he want to handle this? Points out that, well, you're civil defense coordinator, take care
of
it.
You do it. Oh, man.
And so it started from there, but the campus at the time was designed to handle just about 1,500 people. By design, I mean bed space, potable drinking water, whatever.
Kitchen area, I suppose.
Right.
How many did you end up with?
We figured it was over 8,000 people.
And their dogs and cats and birds.
Wow. Wow.
And if you ever get tangled up in a civil defense situation, be very cautious how you handle little old ladies and their pet dogs.
Oh, did you have a run-in with some of them?
Oh, they're more defensive and aggressive than any
in the army, huh?
Oh, hey, weird. Jeez. And I already knew that this is what was going to happen, but when you have to stand there and watch it happen, it gets a little bit nervous.
Well, the phones were out on campus for a while, if I remember rightly.
Right.
So Tom and Katie both went in with Al. He managed to get home in between some of the emergencies. And he took them back one morning to run messages.
Mm-hmm.
Until, what was the device somebody finally fixed up
there
for phones?
A small switchboard up in the West Ridge at that time. And the thing, if you were enough of an electronics type, you could make a special switchboard. And it turned out they could do 9 lines. And all we had to do was get some wire and run between all these.
Mm-hmm.
Which we did because
the Army had
a lot of 110 field line that they laid phone lines with.
Mm-hmm.
And,
so you hooked into the existing system?
Right. After this was all over, some of the officials were very furious because we had damaged their phone system.
By doing this extra circuit?
Yeah. Right.
Where were you operating out of as the civil defense coordinator?
I guess you could say, because it was, the weather turned off nice, the porch on Hess Hall.
Oh, man.
Which was about this high off the ground. And so you could stand there and look out around and see people you know and say that you wanted them over here.
To do something.
Hey, you.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
But,
Well, how were you affected out here on Chino Huskins Road?
Well, that was kind of interesting because we had no power, of course. And
this was August, right?
Yeah.
August of 67?
No. Yeah, that's right. Mark Funk and Bob Lyle, probably one of the Lyles, made the rounds with a little generator and tried to keep people's freezers frozen. And I don't know how it worked for other people, but we ended up canning a bunch of meat because it did thaw. But they tried. And a lot of people had refugees in their homes.
I know my folks did.
Yeah. We didn't because we had a very small house and I had Al going in and out and getting sleep when he could and whatnot. But we did take, a lot of the stuff out of the freezer I took down to Wycliffe.
The Bible camp,
whatever it's called now, because they had a lot of people there. And Harold, if you remember, after the flood, after the water had gone down, brought out, I think, most of the contents of Carr's clothing, the men's clothing
mm-hmm.
store.
I got some of those turtlenecks.
Right. Well, I think we all did, but before they got parceled out.
Wrong. I started it late.
Before it all got parceled out, we had to get it dry.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody, I think, took some home, put in their clotheslines. Well, I had very sturdy clotheslines. They were, log
mm-hmm.
ends and whatnot, but we managed to break them.
You had so many wet clothes.
So much, such wet stuff.
Uh-huh.
And of course, it was gritty, dirty.
Mm-hmm.
So we all, after that, once we got it dry, brought it in and washed it and took it all back to Harold. And then Beatrice, I think, called everybody up. I know she did us and said, oh, for heaven's sakes, come and get whatever you can use.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was no good to the store.
Yeah.
They couldn't do anything with it after that. But heavens, we got everything going.
What about getting food, groceries? Of course, it was summer, so you had your garden.
Yeah, I don't remember that we had any trouble. And I think the people that had a lot of people probably did. But now the Salvation Army was the one that had the bought. Were they the ones, or was it Red Cross that bought all the supplies that were any good at Market Basket or Piggly Wiggly or whoever it was?
Salvation Army bought out several of the small stores. And
which
made the American
mm-hmm.
Red Cross furious because they play the game a different way. And then the Red Cross took all of this and went out to, what's the radio station out where the golf course is now?
KFAR.
KFAR. were starting to dole out and stuff, and they had big stickers that they put on them to show that this was donation from the American Red Cross. When the Red Cross hadn't picked up any of that, it was all
relief work. Huh?
Yeah.
And,
anything else about the flood that you'd want to add?
The Chief Judge Rabinowitz, we have the authority to shut down any bars that were called in province. And he said a loose reading of the law that we were in charge.
Oh, wow.
So the trooper bundles me back in the squad car, and we come back up and shut down the bar that's on Farmer's Loop. Comes up to and over to
a lane. What was that?
You mean the liquor store or the liquor store? Oh,
there's a bar on the where the road used to be.
Oh,
where? Because I'm lost.
Okay,
is the bar still there?
Yes.
Oh, the old Steve. That bar where it goes into off Farmer's Loop.
Right.
Yeah,
oh.
Yeah, it's the graffiti club or something.
Whatever.
It's had a lot of different things.
We shut them down.
How were they a problem during the flood?
Well, they were bringing liquor on campus.
Oh.
And getting
people drunk, 8,000 people.
Causing more trouble.
Right. Oh. Yeah. I see. And they were above flood level.
Must have been.
Because I was thinking the
barely.
Other bars, I'm like, well, I think they'd be underwater.
Yeah. They must have been right on the edge of it, though, because that water came up a long way.
Uh-huh.
There were, four or five guys that got a hold of some kind of a... They were smoking it in a pipe.
Hash?
And it came out of the
first aid supplies or something?
No. The downtown,
pharmacy?
The pharmacy on 2nd Avenue. Co-op Drug.
Mm.
The big husky pharmacist.
Oh, Mac Fenton?
Mac Fenton. Came out of Mac Fenton's place. And whatever it was, and I can't remember now, they were getting higher than a kite and being real rowdy. And so the troopers went in to handle them.
This is on campus in one of the dorms or something?
Right. S Hall, two or three room numbers down the hall from where I was set up on the porch in the front office area. And they were having a rough time handling these troopers.
Well, because the jail was underwater.
Yeah.
Now, there was
no
jail to put anybody in.
This was our temporary jail.
Oh, my goodness.
And so these guys are getting belligerent and turn around and slam their fists through a sheetrock and busting up furniture and whatnot. And we had a pharmacy, not a pharmacy, a...
Infirmary?
Infirmary set up. And one of the nurses that had responded to the thing was a little peep-squeak of a gal that had just gotten to Fairbanks from Sausalitos or someplace down along the coast in California. And she stuck her head around the corner and says, "I understand that you're having some trouble with your prisoners." And one of the cops, the troopers, gets over and he's chatting her up. And she says, "Well, let me see what I can do. I just came from a year and a half in this place in Sausalitos that handles drug problems. And so she disappears for a moment, and what she had done is gone over to the infirmary and talked to one of the doctors into giving her 5 or 6
syringes,
milliliters or something like that.
The hypodermic needle, whatever it was, she and the doc agreed this is what we should use and whatnot. So she comes back and wanders down the hall and whatnot, and the guys start bad mouthing her and whatnot, and she keeps talking and moving around and seeing that she's got a door, a clear way that she can get out if she wants. And one of the troopers is standing there trying to figure out, what do I do here? And about this time, one of them makes a lunge to grab her, and she goes through her dance routine and sidesteps him and hits him in the shoulder with the
needle
thing, and he's, give him 2 minutes, and he's out on the floor, on the deck. And the first thing you know, this whole routine goes again. And about this time, the first sergeant, who has been watching all this going on, comes out in the hall and yells, so-and-so, get your asses up here and watch a professional work. And the guys come out trying to be like, what's he talking about? And so they get down at that end of it all. And they see one of her performances. And first thing you know, she's got all of them.
What a little spitfire, huh?
Right.
Cool.
She must have been quick.
Yeah. Now what... thinking of other little natural disasters, where were you and what was happening when the earthquake of 64 happened? Where were you? How do you remember that?
That was on a Friday evening, right at quitting time, so it was right about 4:28 or something like that. And I was walking south on... what street?
Noble.
Had to be Noble. And I could hear people yelling, and I couldn't figure out what it was because I couldn't see any action area. And I turned the corner and started to cross 3rd Avenue, headed west, and I could hear something going, doing, doing, doing. And I, what the hell is that? And then I hear a bunch of loud yelling, and I could see that it was coming from up on the 6th, 7th, 8th floor.
The top was
of the Northwood building. And I figured, oh, it's one of these Northward divorces where the gal takes all the guy's clothes, opens the window, and shoves it up. Only about that time, my eyes go a little bit higher, and I realize that the twanging that I'm hearing is the cables on the antenna on the TV station up on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And about that time, I hear a bunch of rowdy noises, and there's a bar called the Billiken, and these guys are coming out almost in drill formation. Each guy's got a glass in his hand, and everybody stands there and looks around and whatnot, and the ground is still shaking, and I'm out halfway out in the street trying to look east and see if I can see the ground roll that is.
Okay, and it is going.
Okay.
Okay.
I was curious as to whether there was any damage from stuff coming off shelves, and I was in the town area, so I walked over to What's the gal that sold the...
Doris Dooley.
Doris Dooley's
and
shop.
Bar supplies and party supplies.
And had a bunch of things there that could come off shelves. And there was no damage off shelves. There was a couple of the pressure bottles, the steel bottles, that the bars used to pressurize.
Carbonation?
Carbonated. And that's the only damage that I could spot.
What had happened to them?
They just tipped over onto the floor.
Oh, okay.
And they hadn't broken it.
Mm-hmm. Didn't go off.
No.
No, we were pretty lucky generally.
Yeah, we were far enough away. Is there anything more? No, do you want to tell your earthquake story? You want to just add that?
I don't think it's okay. That interesting.
Is there anything more you'd like to add before we... About being out here, dealing with the survival situation, or the social situation?
All right.
What about the community center?
Well, that was an attempt to generate some community activity. And let's see, the Bounties said they would donate land. And presses out at 12 mile about, just the side of the Little China. Lloyd Press and Betty Press. Lewis was one of their kids.
Yeah,
and
I remember the kids.
Yeah. I remember one. They volunteered the logs from their place.
Wow.
And I know there were a number of weekends that a few people, Tom and Al both got involved, and who else? I think maybe Rudy, I'm not sure.
Wasn't the 4-H Club raising money for that?
Probably so.
And
the homemakers. A few men would go out and cut some logs and whatnot, but it never got off the ground. We never got past that point that I remember.
What do you think was the reason for that?
Well, again, I think it's because everybody went to town for church, and you all went to town for school.
Mm-hmm.
And there just wasn't enough here to keep us interested.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike, as I say, Two Rivers, where they were far enough away that they do things together.
No driving force of any one individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is what it takes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wasn't enough interest, period. That's always been the problem. Now the only community we have, of course, is to do with the road commission, the road system.
That's true.
And that's minimal. The only time we get a really good turnout there is when they threaten to raise the mill levy. And then we get lots of participation.
Yeah.
But once the homemakers dissolved, we really just didn't have cohesion whatsoever. And that ran out when we all got older, we all got tired.
And there was no new out of 4-H.
Yeah, that was certainly part of it. And there was no new blood coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the end of it.
Is there anything that you would, if you had to do over again with you're coming here or being part of the neighborhood, that you would do any differently than you did? Or suggest?
With the what we had to work with, I don't think so. I mean, if we'd had a lot of money, it might have been a difference.
Yeah.
We would have had a better road lot earlier, for one thing.
Right.
But we couldn't have done anything about the Hot Springs Road, which was no small part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think of anything. Do you? Anything you would have done different?
Or any suggestions for people who kind of move to a new place?
And is controlled by governmental agencies, and access to his control in energy and time, getting access just to some place to do something.
Mm-hmm.
time you've burned out all that money, energy, et cetera, what have you got left to use to...
For your improvement.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And so it's either the homestead should be larger or the homestead should be much smaller. And
more manageable.
Well, you wouldn't expect, small enough you wouldn't expect to make a living off of.
Yeah.
Because you can't make a living off of 160 acres.
Right.
But maybe you could make a living off 300 acres.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in interior Alaska, though, I don't think.
Now, one thing you didn't talk about is you maintained and created a bunch of trails back here, right?
Oh, well, actually what we did was, or what I did, because it was mostly me with some help, kind of cleared out some trails that had been made earlier, and I always assumed that some of them had to do with the fields, that were cleared to the north, and they probably had taken a tractor through
there.
But some of them possibly dated back to the older days when they were coming out here for trapping and wood cutting and whatnot. Because you can see...
We'll get this so that it sounds like these are recreational trails and that the all these people have a right to be there without talking to us, the landowner. So you need to carefully phrase it.
Yeah.
Well, this is on your private property.
Yeah. Right. Well,